Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 25th of December 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, a very Merry Christmas to all you listeners out there. Of course, this is actually being recorded before Christmas, and we do have a very special guest today. We have someone who has tirelessly been campaigning and highlighting the revisionist cause for some decades now, and it is Lady Michelle Renouf. Michelle, welcome to the show, and of course, a Merry Christmas to you, even though it's not actually Christmas today.
Thank you, Sven, and happy Yuletide and happy solstice on the 21st to you and to all of our listeners.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And of course, at this time of year, we also have to remember that there are a lot of nationalists that are imprisoned for their activism and also a lot of historical revisionists who are imprisoned for their activism. And one that was released recently was Ursula Haverbeck, which I was so pleased to hear that she had been released. I mean, the lady is in her 90s now, and I was really shocked to hear that they're trying to put her in prison again. Is this true?
Yes, it is, Sven. Ursula Haverbeck is a wonderful person. At the moment, she's out of prison, but she will again be on trial next year. But I have to say that apropos of my arrest in Dresden in 2018 and the consequence of the trial, when my arresting officer, the first thing he said to me when he was carting me into the van, he said, "Do you know Haverbeck?" And of course, I said, "I not only know her, she's a personal friend, and I think iconic for the highest qualities that a German woman could have." At the same time, of course, I asked them how many Antifa that they had arrested for having that big banner that they regularly put up, "Bomber Harris, do it again." So Ursula actually featured somewhat in my statement to the police. Yes, she's a wonderful woman, and in fact, I have captured, you see, a lot of the interviews that I have captured have been quite unique from the point of view of their being in English. As far as I know, still the interview that I captured of Ursula some years ago is perhaps the only one that is in English. Many of the people that now have gone, like Dr. Herbert Schaller, who defended Irving, David Irving, and lots of these people who have gone, unfortunately, only gave an interview to me in English. It's an extraordinary thing that I thought that there would be so many people capturing and recording these trials across Europe and in Canada and so on. To my dismay, it was only on one occasion when I met Christopher Bolin at the Mannheim court. But other than that, there doesn't appear to be anyone capturing it in English. And you think, well, somebody else must be doing it. But when you realize that no one is, you know, that's how I came to be doing it, because I saw that these things were not being made available to the English-speaking world. And I think it's quite important. I'd say, actually, Sven, that most of our listeners will associate revisionism with brave Germans, such as the jailed frequently jailed, she wasn't jailed for 2.5 years, the 92-year-old Ursula Haverbeck, also Horst Mahler, who was incarcerated until recently despite having both his legs amputated, and attorney Sylvia Stoltz. She was jailed for daring to defend her clients as the judge in Mannheim, I heard him say as well, that if she defends her revisionist clients, quote, too well, she will be prosecuted. And indeed, she was prosecuted and went to prison. And then later on, for several years, and then later on, she gave a speech about her imprisonment at a conference in Switzerland. And then she was again prosecuted for even speaking of her incarceration, and so she's pretty much likely to be released soon. So there is this, and of course the judges themselves. You know, I've made DVDs about jailing opinions, then jailing the lawyers, and it's a possibility that one might be able to make a film called Jailing the Judges, because the judges you see themselves, they cannot judge anything other than what is the basic law. And I learned that from Sylvia Stoltz, that she's the German attorney, the young German attorney. She told me during the recess, actually, when Alfred and Monica Schaefer were on trial in Munich, and I was covering that for the Barnes Review magazine. And during the recess, when they tell me what was going on, the legalities of it, Sylvia explained to me that the basic law for the Federal Republic of Germany. One of the authors of it, let me think his name, Carlo Schmidt, he was the one who had drawn attention to the fact that Germany at that time, when this basic law was being drawn up, did not have its sovereignty, but he anticipated that this would be a temporary situation and that once Germany was reunification came about, that this sovereignty would be readdressed and that the Germans would again have sovereignty over their nation. But in fact, they don't. And one of the aspects that would have been brought out in my trial, that was meant to be a couple of months ago in Dresden, this kind of embarrassing, these facts would have come out during a series of my trials. And as my German attorney, who's the same German attorney for Ursula Haferbeck, he pointed out that in the end, 2 days before the trial, the judge and prosecutor backed down. An extraordinary thing, he said, that has never happened before, since I was accused under the same criminal code as Ursula and Sylvia, the para 130 of incitement and Holocaust denial, etc., that it was extraordinary that they back down, and he believes that because they don't have to give a reason, but he believes the reason was that the contents of my trial, plus the exceptional notoriety that the international press give me for one reason or another during all through my life, as it happens, they were afraid that of the embarrassment that some of the facts that I would be bringing forth, including, of course, the law under which I was being prosecuted would be examined. And all of this caused them in the end, he said, that the political overlords in Germany probably had a hand in suddenly deciding that they would simply back away from the case. But in the case of Horst and Ursula and Sylvia, they will probably have more trials because their case is the case they make. It was rather different to the case that I made, even though we were all prosecuted under the same code. So one can only applaud these people and most especially Ursula, because she has been able to conduct her case simply on the grounds of being able to ask a question. And this is, for me, the right way to go about it, because there's a possibility, you see, a possibility of acquittal, even though the basic law, and of course the Federation is actually based on, Dr. Schaller, if I can just find what Dr. Schaller said, well, I can't find the quote in front of me at the moment, but Dr. Schaller was the was the wonderful Viennese attorney who got David Irving out of prison, you may remember, in 2006, when he was there for 10 months. And Dr. Schaller was the one who, on appeal, that is, and he said that the law is such that anything that is not Marxist is illegal, you see. This is the hamstrung situation that these countries that have adopted the Holocaust denial law are under. That is why I was always very interested in Hassemer and Hoffmann-Riem. These were the two ex-constitutional court judges who said that the Holocaust denial law should be repealed, and that the idea of speech being incitement in terms of simply drawing attention to certain facts or even querying certain facts should not be regarded as incitement. And of course, I have always tried to press for public awareness of the international teaching guidelines for teaching about the Holocaust, because it says on page 11, and I've even managed to quote it in 2008 on the BBC. Can you imagine when Bishop Williamson came from Argentina, and there was a question of his being extradited to Germany? When he was coming out of prison, the BBC approached me, and they had me on they had me on the news, the World at One, and they also had me on the World Service, the BBC World Service, opposite Deborah Lipstadt. And on that program, the program was called, and this is 2008, it will never happen again, but then it was called Why Can't We Question the Holocaust? And I was on the BBC for 2 hours taking calls from all around the world whilst Deborah Lipstadt was accusing me of spewing hate. But in fact, all I was doing was quoting from those teaching guidelines. And it says, Sven, that, quote, care should be taken not to give a platform for deniers, and what they mean by deniers is skeptics, returning to the quote, nor seeking to undermine their arguments using normal historical debate and rational argument. So that there is the quote from the International Teaching Guidelines for the Holocaust, where teachers are told that they must not allow normal historical debate and rational argument to enter into the teaching about this particular this exceptionalist subject. So it is, of course, obviously being taught as one would teach a religion.
Is that British faith. Guidelines? Is that British guidelines, or is that sort of world guidelines?
No, international guidelines, Ben. International guidelines that were drawn up in Stockholm in 2000, and they were reiterated in 2008, and they are the standing guidelines for teaching about the Holocaust in schools around the world, not just in Britain.
Well, that goes against standard.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
Doesn't that go against in Britain, because we don't have Holocaust denial laws in Britain? It's something that we can actually be quite proud of, the fact that we don't have them. I think 20 odd countries in Europe have them, and they prevent people from investigating history and asking questions, but we don't have that in Britain. So that shouldn't be the guidelines for the teaching about this in Britain.
Yes, but it is only because of the success we had with Dr. Frederick Tobin in 2008, that we have not adopted those that Holocaust denial law via the back door. You see, because it was David Duke, a great pal of mine, who rang me to say, I've heard that Frederick has been imprisoned because he was in transit at Heathrow Airport. And so I heard about directly. I heard about it from David, and then contacted Frederick, and found, because I knew Frederick, of course, I'd met him in Australia and so on. And so he and I'd heard that he'd actually, well, he'd sort of given a, because he's a philosopher as well as a revisionist, he'd given the magistrate in answer to his defense, he said, well, the whole world is my prison. And so I was able to contact him through the solicitor to speak to Frederick. And I said, Frederick, I have interviewed Dr. Herbert Schaller a year ago as to how did Dr. Schaller manage to get Irving out of prison. And he gave me, Dr. Schaller gave me at his home in Vienna, a 4-hour wonderful interview in which he described how he conducts it and why they henceforth created a law especially to stop Herbert Schaller from practicing again. So I said to Frederick Tobin, would you like me to mobilize a defense and carry it out as per what I've learned from Dr. Schaller? And so Frederick said, well, you know, by all means, go ahead. I don't think he thought that we would have any success, but he was happy enough for me to do so. And that defense, we won, Sven. It was it's not really as widely known as it ought to be, really, that we can be very, very proud of what we achieved there with that. And I'm certainly very proud that it was I who mounted that that defense, because nobody else was doing so, which is an extraordinary thing. And neither would I had I not had that wonderful interview with Dr. Schaller.
What were they doing then? You know, were they holding Dr. Frederick Tobin and wanting to extradite him to Germany or something? And they were holding him in Britain.
Yes, you remember it well. Yes, that's right. They were. This was the new law. You know, the European arrest warrant. And what they wanted to do was to quote harmonize. They wanted English law to harmonize, is the word, with the Holocaust denial law at the same time as not. So that they could, so that there were two Jews at that time, whose name I can't recall just for the moment, but they were boasting how we English were not were adopting this. We had kept our free speech and so on, but they were of course quite happy to support the idea of the extradition of Tobin, which would have meant that we would have adopted via the back door, this harmonizing with the German law at the same time as not actually accepting it as a statute. And what would have occurred then is that Tobin would have been extradited to Mannheim prison. And when the Bishop Williamson came back from Argentina, the situation would have been then that his extradition could have been rubber stamped, that he would not necessarily have a trial in England, but he would have his trial in Germany. And so that success prevented that from happening, and of course prevented other people, such as ourselves, from being extradited. But it would be very wrong for people to imagine that English people going to Germany and saying whatever they think they want to and imagining that they can flee. This is completely wrong, because I had when I gave my statement to the arresting officer who charged me and so on, I said to him that I agreed that I would come back for the trial. But, of course, had I had not agreed, they could certainly have extradited me. We are not immune because of what we did for Tobin and the bishop. We are not immune. So that is a very wrong idea that some people put out, and that is wrong. But certainly in the trial that I should have stood for in a couple of months ago, I actually was in Germany and in fact cancelled my interim flights back to London in case of the quarantine or the lockdown would have prevented me from going back to Germany, to Dresden, to face the trial. I wanted to confront the matter because I believed that there was a good chance that I could be acquitted. And in any case, I would have been able to draw a great deal of attention because of this sort of peculiar celebrity that I've had one way or another with the international press all through my life. And the arrest, my arrest itself made international news. So the trial would certainly have done so. You know, that was extraordinary that they backed down in the end.
No, it really is. It really is. Well, what you're saying there is, if people are in Germany and they're British, they can't think that just because they're British they can break the German law in talking about these things.
But absolutely not. No.
If you are in Britain, you can't be extradited.
Absolutely not. No. The Germans backed down 2 days before my trial has nothing to do with that. It was, as my lawyer said, and Ursula's lawyer, and also Monica's lawyer, Wolfram Narad, wonderful. I can't praise him more highly for the astute devotion that he has to these trials and so on. Wonderful person. I gave a very he gave a wonderful interview to the Nordic Frontier, with which I know you're associated. Last week, or earlier this week, in fact.
Yes, it was a good interview.
In which he explains all of this, really, yes.
It was a good interview.
A wonderful interview. It's historic, that interview. I really believe that. Well worth, I would advise our listeners to try and listen to the Nordic Frontier.
Well, just talking there about Britain and the British laws. So we don't actually have a Holocaust denial law here, but we have had persecution of people in the past, you were telling me. And because when you mentioned that you wanted to talk about persecution of British revisionists, I was thinking, well, have we had any persecution of British revisionists? Because we don't have this law. And you came up with a list of people that had actually got into trouble for historical revisionism. So do you want to go into some of them and talk about some of them for a bit?
Well, yes, because I was thinking, Sven, that most, as I say, most listeners will associate revisionism with Germans such as Horst, Sylvia, and Ursula Haverbeck. But will they associate revisionism? Of course, and they will associate it too with the late great half Scot, half French Professor Robert Faurisson, or they might associate it with his fellow scholar in the USA, Professor Arthur Butts, you know, the author of the Hoax of the 20th Century, or they may associate it with the German Canadian artist and publisher and publicity genius Ernst Zundel, the late great Ernst Zundel, dear friend, or they might associate it with the American execution expert Fred Leuchter, or the German scientist now resident in the USA, Germar Rudolph. I attended Germar Rudolph's trial in Mannheim, but very few of our listeners, and perhaps even fellow Britons, will associate historical revisionism with the UK. But in fact, a great deal of pioneering revisionist work took place in this country. It's not widely known. One of the most widely distributed revisionist texts, Did 6 Million Really Die?, was written in 1974 by the young National Front activist Richard Verrill, later National Front deputy chairman, under the pseudonym Richard Harwood. I'm sure you know of this. And during the 1980s and 90s, two editions of a tabloid-style Holocaust news were published and distributed worldwide by British nationalists. And the main distributor was, of course, Richard Edmonds, a great veteran of patriotic revisionism, who was then national organizer of the British National Party. So throughout this period, until shortly before his death in 2012, the most important printer of the revisionist text was Tony Hancock, based in Sussex, and an indispensable figure in late 20th century revisionism. As a matter of fact, the film that I made and to which I referred in my speech in Dresden, Dresden Holocaust 1945, An Apology to Germany is Due, I dedicated it to Tony Hancock, because I think he was a person who deserved much more. In his lifetime, ideally wished that we'd been able to give him more public accreditation than was given to him, really. He was quite heroic, as was his father, in putting all of this this material, making it available, really. And ever since the early 1960s, though primarily a military historian rather than a Holocaust, in quotes, historian, the most widely read challenger of World War II orthodoxy, including aspects of the Holocaust orthodoxy, has been the British historian David Irving, of course. But unlike most European countries, as we have been talking about, the UK has never had a statute especially criminalizing Holocaust denial law. Yet, although Verrill, Hancock, and Edmonds were all targeted in various ways by the authorities, the media, and the so-called anti-fascists, so you know they weren't imprisoned, but they tried to attack them in any which way they could. And we do have the Race and Religious Act. So ever since Verrill's time, official documents, some of which are available in the UK National Archive, and that was some of the stuff that I was reading out at the Dresden commemoration, show that prosecutors repeatedly considered using the race laws against the revisionists. The potential prosecution case was that revisionism was in itself insulting to Jews and in itself either intended or likely to incite racial hatred. So that is how that we don't have the Holocaust denial law, but that is how it was going to be enacted under a different code. So Tony Hancock's premises were twice subjected to arson attacks by well-financed, the Antifa, very well-financed, and Richard Edmonds was twice forced out of his job. The second time after the Sunday Times journalist investigated his role as a Holocaust news distributor, and they found out where he worked. So they not only kept smashing his windows of the shop that he had, but they also found out where he worked, and he lost his job. So there are other ways, aside from putting people in prison, of destroying them in one way or another. And, of course, David Irving, for heaven's sake, was, of course, jailed for 10 months in Austria, as I referred to a little earlier, and has been subject to physical attacks. I was there when he was physically attacked in Arundel, and decades of demonization engineered to stop him being able to sell his books, you know, by stopping the distribution outlets. Of course, you can write a book, publish it, but it's the distribution that matters. It has now been, and that's what his civil action in 2000 against Deborah Lipsat was all about. She had stopped him from the distribution. It has now been established in articles by Peter Rushton in Heritage and Destiny that part of this demonization was coordinated during the late 1930s and early 1970s by an official Foreign Office propaganda agency known as the Information Research Department. So, you know, there's they've been on the case of these people, you know, one way or another, destroying them without putting them necessarily in prison. So, in fact, the heritage of historical revisionism in Britain goes all the way back to the 1940s. And, you know, there was this eminent British military historian, Major General J.F.C. Fuller, whose books are still a part of the standard syllabus for trainee British Army officers in Sandhurst, and he expressing views about German concentration camps, even during the war, that would now see him jailed in Europe and probably in Britain under our modern race laws. Fuller visited the Oranienburg concentration camp, the one that's north of Berlin, just before the outbreak of the Second World War, and he wrote about his impressions in an article by the for the journalist Truth. A publication was close to Chamberlain's Downing Street press office, and of course Chamberlain himself featured in my Dresden speech, or would have been in my trial. So that by the time that this article was written and published in Truths, I think it was November 1939, that edition, Britain and Germany were at war, although it was the so-called phony war, you know, the low-intensity conflict that could at any time have been settled by sensible negotiations, as the great Alan Clark pointed out, rather than the suicidal total war that erupted once Churchill was, this warmongering Churchill was prime minister. And so many of these peace proposals by the Third Reich that were ignored by Churchill, endless. I mean, the idea that the public, the British public, were not allowed to know about the peace proposal, endless peace proposals, is criminal in itself. And so despite these wartime circumstances, Fuller's article praised the good order and the cleanliness of the Oranienburg camp and had little time for its its Jewish inmates, who certainly at that stage of the war would have been locked up for criminality or political subversion rather than simply as Jews. And of course, my speech in Dresden tried to point out that internment of fifth columnists should not be regarded in itself as criminal, which of course this is in the public mind. They have put the public mind, when you see these people, you know, Germany is blamed for putting them into concentration camps. But as I tried to say, and was, of course, one of my so-called crimes, is that it was not especially cruel of the Germans to put their fifth columnists into concentration camps, because all other countries do the same. We did, and so on. American did, and so on. And, of course, the thing is that it was the leaders, the world Jewish leaders at that time, like Chaim Weizmann and Jabotinsky, they indicted all of their people in what they said and did. They're because their economic war, Judea declares an economic war, and lots of subterfuge that we now know about through the archive. Of course, many of the people would not have been fifth columnists, but that's not how it happens, Sven, in wartime. Whether you want to be part of the war or not, you become the enemy. And therefore, it was the Jewish leaders themselves who indicted their people and caused the Germans to be putting them, mostly, of course, the criminals. Not all Jews were put into concentration camps. There were many Jews living perfectly happily in Berlin and so on, and we know all that too. So, all of this I would have brought out, of course, in my trial, which, of course, is not something that they want brought out. Yes, Sven, so, you know, despite these wartime circumstances, Fuller's article praised the order, the good order of this camp. And he said, in his own words, he said, quote, never before seen, he never before seen so many degenerates collected together. You're talking about these Jewish criminals and politicals. And he added, whether these concentration camps are barbarous or not, a civilization which produces such creatures is one to be fought against rather than fought for. So that's our... that's a man whose books are still a standard syllabus. I don't say they allow anybody to know what he said about these camps, but that is nevertheless he is a Brit that we can rather be proud of in terms of, in a sense, he was really a pre-Holocaust revisionist, Fuller, really.
He's very courageous of him.
since he was writing about concentration camps rather than the alleged death camps, at the time when executions and the homicidal gas chamber, of course, there were gas chambers. We certainly know that disinfectant, but we're talking about these alleged homicidal gas chambers and all the rest of the allegations, before they had even arisen as a narrative that we've been told.
It's very objective
endlessly in these things. So
it's very objective of him, isn't it? At the time, you think, that's in the middle of a war against Germany, and he's being objective and talking about the camps and saying that they're clean, they're well looked after, and the people that are in them deserve to be within them, basically. At the time when Britain is at war with Germany, that's very objective of him and courageous, I would say, to speak out like that.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And of course, there were several very early historical revisionists in Britain, ranging from the Scottish Protestant evangelist Alexander Ratcliffe, and there was also the Duke of Bedford, and there was the New Zealander from a political exile family. But let me just—I've got a quote here, actually, from Alexander Ratcliffe, which I think our listeners will be very interested in. He said this in April 1945 in the edition called The Protestant Vanguard, and I quote him: "Once this war is over, folks will snigger at the German, quote, atrocity yarns." Of course, we'd already had those atrocity yarns in the First World War, cutting off hands and so on, which has been apologized for, of course. That is why we called our the telling films in which Richard Edmonds was very much concerned, an apology. The subtitle of my film, the Dresden Holocaust 1945, the subtitle is "An Apology to Germany is Due." And that is why we're rather hoping that at some stage an apology will be, just as it was in the World War One, when the propaganda was seen to be what it is. I mean, wartime propaganda should finish at the end of a war. It should not continue. So just returning, I'm sorry, to Ratcliffe's quote, he said, they will actually wonder how they could be so easily deluded. Especially they will wonder how they could swallow the silly yarns about the wholesale massacre of millions of Jews. A shock is coming to the people, and no doubt they will ultimately discover that the actual real atrocity that did take place was in 1939, when the country was tricked, when our country was tricked, by interested financiers to declare war against Protestant Germany, end quote. So here is a person who sees the Brothers' War, the intergentile war, as the real crime. And of course, so did Chamberlain, really. I mean, Chamberlain was the one who warned that this was a war that was different to all other wars, that, this bombing, this terror bombing, would be aiming at civilians, a thing that no soldier is allowed to do. So, I'm rather proud, actually, that my matrimonial home used to be the home of the Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who did seek peace, and of course his opposite was the warmongering Churchill. But the other aspect to talk about is this this count, Montauk. He had the unusual distinction of not only being one of the first Holocaust revisionists, but also one of the first to state accurately that the Soviets, not the Germans, were responsible for the massacre of the Polish officers and intellectuals at Katyn. This count, Potocki, his reward, of course, for publishing the truth about Katyn, was to be arrested by the Metropolitan Police Special Branch, imprisoned, so he was imprisoned, and then sent to work for the rest of the war on a remote agricultural camp in Northumberlandshire. So there is one person who actually in that period certainly did go to prison. And of course, while few listeners would especially associate Sir Oswald Mosley with Holocaust revisionism, in fact, he made several comments in his 1947 book, The Alternative, that is broadly similar to some of the comments for which I was, until 2 months ago, being prosecuted in Dresden. Mosley wrote that the horrific conditions in many camps that had been revealed at the end of the war had developed only towards the end of the war's end, and, to quote him, were largely produced by Allied bombing and consequent epidemics, end quote. That's his words, especially typhus. He added at a press conference in London, when he was launching his book in 1947, and I'm quoting from that too, "If you have typhus outbreaks, you are bound to have a situation where you have to use the ovens to get rid of the bodies. If you had been bombed here, if we had been bombed here in prisons and concentration camps, there would have been a few of us going into the ovens." That's end quote. So that's from Sir Oswald Mosley. So far as internment itself was concerned, Mosley, who had of course been interned without trial in Britain under the regulation 18B, he also wrote, quote, "Men were short, food was short. Disorder raged as all supply," he's talking about Germany, of course, "supply services broke down under the incessant bombing. They held in prison or camps a considerable disaffected population, some German but most alien, who were regarding, who were requiring guards and good food supplies." So that's the end of that little quote I have there from Mosley. But fundamentally, Mosley, like many of us, viewed the outbreak of war itself as the real atrocity. And so, of course, did Chamberlain, you know, the real crime. And again, here's Mosley, what he's saying here, quote, "Modern war is the end of morality. Those responsible for bringing war are also responsible for ending morality," end quote. And that is, you know, what I like, Sven, so much about the leader of the Patriotic Alternative, Mark Collett, and you, and of course Laura Towler, is you know, the three of you are in the vein for me of Chamberlain, in as much as you are concerned to communicate to the people. You're not interested in creating some sort of faction, the way that Mark Collett approaches the matter. I did praise that actually when I was speaking to Andreas on the frontier, the Nordic frontier, the week before Wolfram Narrat spoke to them, because Mark takes the right approach in how to recruit people, how not to allow, as he calls, that guy to undermine the flavor of the gatherings and the purpose of it, not to sort of have it as a cheap baiting session, but to make something that is welcoming for normal people to want to associate and to come to understand via attending those kind of trials. So those kind of events that he very well organizes. So I think we have now what I would consider the perhaps a strange thing to say, but I would say that Mark Collett and you and Laura are in the vein of the better aspect of Neville Chamberlain. You know, your approach is his. There's real principled Britishness in it, like Neville Chamberlain.
Oh, that's quite a compliment.
And you are recruiting, therefore, principled British people. We don't want other than British principled people. And I believe that that is a wonderful thing, that this Patriotic Alternative is a wonderful organization, and it carries the vein and carries the principle and ethics that represent and what British people wish to be represented by. And I think Mark Collett is doing a fantastic job, and you and Laura, in representing the kind of people that the British wish to be identified with.
We try to set a good example. Try to set a good example and highlight the fact that we have to have morals. We used to be known for being extremely just and extremely moral throughout the world. And when you look at the country today, it's so degenerate, and there's just immorality everywhere. And that's not what the British people were about. I mean, if you look at the Third World, and when we were in the British Empire, we brought law and order to these places, and they would far rather have been judged by a British judge than by their own people, because they knew their own people were corrupt. And that's the sort of people we were back then, and that's the sort of people that we need to be today. And I think the change happened with the war. As you say, that was the end of morality. That war was the end of it all, and the Nuremberg trials afterwards, the kangaroo court that put that in place, and then these speech laws since then, it can all be traced back to the Second World War and the lies that were told in it, and then the institutionalizing of these lies and making laws throughout Europe to enforce them. So I'm very pleased to hear about all these British people that were speaking up about this and trying to put a stop to it. Unfortunately, they failed. That's the saddest thing, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the thing is that apropos Ursula, again, just return to Ursula, and one could, and what you're saying about the Nuremberg trials, because, of course, I referred to the Nuremberg trials as a farce in my speech in Dresden. You know, that was another one of my criminal acts, you see. But I'd quite like to quote to our listeners what the late, great Professor Robert Faurisson said. Because he said the establishment of tribunals at which the victors, acting both as judge and prosecutors, put the vanquished on trial in patently sham proceedings, the trials of that kind allowed the children of Israel to extract vengeance on octogenarians or octogenarians accused on the street. Jewish testimonies of, quote, crimes against humanity. And because so much of that was put as evidence in the Nuremberg trials, 1945 to 46, Sefton Delmer put copies of so-called evidence and so on. It was simply a farce. It was. And as any five-year-old knows, that if the prosecutor and the judge are one and the same, it's not going to be a fair trial. How can it be? So when the allies, all liars, are the ones who are actually dictating whether the people like Goering can speak, and when he can't speak, and so on, all of our situation now, these laws and the wars ever since, have been based on this the so-called findings of the Nuremberg trial, and so is the UN is based on these findings. And one of the things that I was trying to point out in Dresden was the significance of the Dresden Holocaust. And of course, it was on 60 German towns and cities, not just Dresden. But that the idea was that our policymakers had deliberately targeted civilians, that we had Bronowski actually on American soil, mathematically calculating and creating atmospheric conditions where they could test, in effect, how many civilians that they could kill per square meter. And they chose to bomb the working class areas because their gardens were smaller and they could get more people killed. They were aiming at killing. It wasn't collateral damage. It wasn't the same as what the Germans did bombing. The bombing the Germany did was to do with military targets or a military decision at that time. But this bombing of policy led by Churchill and helped by the mathematical scientists like Bronowski, Lindemann, and Portal, this was all done prior. This was all premeditated, and it was all intended to target civilians. As Neville Chamberlain said, it's illegal to target civilians. A soldier cannot do. This is why this war was different. And the point that I tried to make is that not only was it dreadful as a war crime, which, of course, was never recognized at the Nuremberg trials, but it was also the precedent by which this so-called moral bombing, as they call it, allowed all wars ever since to target civilians. And in consequence of targeting civilians, we've not only committed war crimes ourselves on these areas in the Middle East and Afghanistan, but we have also created enemies that we didn't have before. And consequently, we have people who want to do us harm at the same time as having as we have created harm, and also we are bringing to our white countries only the refugees. I'm talking about refugees as opposed to economic migrants now, and that's what I talked about in Dresden, because just across the road from where we all stood, I mean, there were, just to paint the picture there, Sven, there were about 300 mourners at this Dresden commemoration. And there were up 300 Antifa screaming, yelling, and trying to drown us down, which they didn't succeed to do. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of police. This was the scene. And so I said that across the road, there's a big sign painted in white letters about 1 foot high in English, interestingly enough, Sven, in English, in Dresden. And it said, "Good night, white pride." And I was so incensed by this that I, of course, couldn't help mentioning it in my 10-minute impromptu speech. And I said, well, I will say, hello, white pride. And all this idea of white privilege that we hear, frankly, it should be a privilege for third worlders to be in white countries. It is their privilege to be here among us, because as Joe Sobran, the late Joe Sobran, the author in America, he said, well, doesn't it tell us something that it's not the mass migrating of colored third worlders? It's not white people who are mass migrating to third world countries. It is the third world that wish to mass migrate to white countries. They are happy to be socially engineered to come to white countries. They don't flee to their nearby countries, which have their language and their culture. They don't want to be among their own people. They want to be among white people. So it's about time white people stood up and said, it's your privilege to be among us. And we're very happy to help you to learn the things that have drawn you to want to be among us. But you need to take those skills back to your own countries and take pride in your heritage and your race. And this is where Dr. David Duke and I are very much on the same page. We believe that we should be trying to inculcate pride in the people of other races. Certainly, they show a certain amount of pride where they have their same their costume and their hair and their jewelry and so on. We see that with the Black Lives Matter. But they don't have sufficient pride to wish to go back to their native lands. And for heaven's sake, Africa is so rich in geology and everything else. Well, of course, we're not allowed to say black now, are we, Sven? We're not allowed to say coloured. And at one time I got into trouble for calling somebody coloured. So what is it? I mean, here we have people who want to be proud of being black. They're allowed to call for Black Lives Matter, but for some reason or other, we aren't allowed to call them black.
So, it's bizarre, isn't it? It changes all the time.
The linguistics of it all is just a pack of cards. It's all advertising skill and nothing more, really.
Well, I think back there when you were mentioning the Nuremberg trials and the precedent that was set with the bombing, I think another precedent was set there as well, which was again which you were pointing to, where the supposed victim is also the judge, and the speech laws that we have since then, that is enshrined in that, is that the victim themselves is the judge. If somebody is an ethnic minority and they say they think something was is hate speech and they're a victim of it, then they are taken down as being a victim, and we have these hate crime incidents that are there now, and it is effectively the victim is now the judge, and the case is not actually going to be judged on the merit. It's just if somebody is from one of these ethnic minorities, they can allege the crime, and therefore there is a crime, and I think that goes back to Nuremberg, where you had exactly the same thing. You had the people that had prosecuted the war that were then standing as judges and making the accusations. So that they were effect judge, jury, and executioner. So that the people in the dock had no chance whatsoever. That there's so much that goes back to the war that is responsible for everything that goes on today. That's why it's so important to study it, and it's so important that we have people like yourself that draw attention to this and devote your time to this and make documentaries and make interviews with these historians. And I'm just so pleased that you came on today and you've given us all this information, and I'm sure the listeners are really going to enjoy this. Thank you very much for coming on today, Michelle. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back in the new year with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you enjoy the rest of your Christmas and have a very happy new year.